This is the current federal tax developments for the week of September the 28th, 2015. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. We're going to take a look at some of the developments that took place over the past week in the area of federal taxes. And again, we had a number of developments take place this week, so we're going to cover them somewhat rapidly. First up is the IRS issuance of final regulations under Treasury Decision 9739. That relates to the definition of what is an F-reorg. Reorganizations basically are things that are allowed, are transitions of corporate ownership or corporate structure that do not trigger a current tax recognition. If you meet any of the requirements are found in Section 368A1 of the code, and the letters following that are what we refer to as the A, B, C, D, etc., in this case, F-reorg. An F-reorganization, for those who are not used to these sorts of things, is a mere change in identity, form, or place of organization of one corporation, however affected. So traditionally, that had been like an explanation where we had been incorporated in Ohio, and then we simply reincorporate the same corporation in Oklahoma. That's a traditional F-reorg. The regulations will provide a set of 6 tests to be applied to see if a transaction qualifies as an F-reorg. Now, this information, more details about each of these tests can be found in our materials on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. So if you go there and check for the postings for this week, you'll find basically this information related to this particular transaction. But the 6 tests are going to be, number 1, did the resulting corporate stock distributed in exchange for the transfer or corporation stock? Number 2, is there an identity of stock ownership between the two entities? Number 3, are the prior assets or attributes of the resulting corporation going to, you know, do they have any of those things ahead of time? They shouldn't. Is the transfer or corporation liquidated following the transaction? Generally, it should be. Is the resulting corporation the only acquiring corporation? That's a requirement. And the transfer or corporation has to be the only acquired corporation in the transaction. If you meet these tests, you have potentially an F-reorg. However, sometimes we can meet these tests, but we may also meet the test for another one of the lettered reorgs. In that case, the regulations at 1.368-2M3iv tell us how to tie break in that case. The regulations go on to give us 13 examples of applying these regulations to various transactions. Lots of times an F-reorg is pretty simple. We know we've got it, like that simple case of we have an Ohio corporation that we simply reincorporate into Oklahoma. But other times things are more complicated. If you have a more complicated situation, you want to go back, take a look at these regulations, what's changed, what's available in them, and then make sure you handle properly the classification. More importantly, if you're planning a transaction that you believe will be an F-reorg, make sure that you meet all the requirements in these new regulations. Next up, we're going to have a special case here. We're going to follow through on an extension of something we talked about earlier. More information on the impact of the case of the estate of Belmont that was discussed earlier. This is the estate of DeMarco versus Commissioner, TC Memorandum Decision 2015-184. As was the case in the case of Belmont, we have funds set aside by the estate for charitable purposes. Under Section 642C of the Code, an estate that permanently sets aside funds for a charitable purpose is allowed a current deduction for that charitable contribution, assuming that the funds come out of income and meet all the other requirements for a charitable contribution on a fiduciary income tax return. But you have to essentially set those funds aside, and even if they're not paid for 10 years, you're going to get the deduction, but you have to assure they'll be used for a charitable purpose. Now, that opens up an obvious problem. If the charity still has the assets, the question quickly becomes, how can we be sure they won't be used, or not the charity, I should say, but the trust or estate, how can we be sure they won't be used for other issues, especially if there is, let's say, a dispute among the heirs regarding the disposition of assets? In this case, there was just such a dispute. And the court found in this case that the mere existence of that dispute is sufficient to make it enough at risk that these funds will not be dedicated to the charitable purpose to deny the current deduction. Now, the court implicitly uses a dual date test here. It's looking for whether we were aware, in essence, do we have information that indicated it was a more than remote chance the funds might be used for a non-charitable purpose, either as of the end of the tax year, when we're claiming the set aside, or as of the date the return was filed. If that's true at either one of those dates, we appear to have a problem. In this case, it was true at both dates. Now, unlike the Belmont case, where in the Belmont case, not only had there been a theoretical challenge, that challenge went forward, and eventually they did end up spending down so much money that they had less money left in the estate by the time we got to trial, then they had claimed as a set-aside deduction. In this case, that had not happened, but the court found that was irrelevant. The question is the risk. If the risk is more than remote, which is a very low level of risk, then the estate cannot claim a current deduction. This causes us problems because if you remember the Belmont case, that particular trust had received a distribution from a retirement plan that was currently taxable. They needed the current charitable contribution to offset that or else they would owe current income tax. But the problem was, because of the existence of the dispute, that deduction would be delayed until all of those issues were resolved. Obviously, that creates a problem. It can create it here. So be very careful. If you're going to make use of 642C, be careful. Number two thing to remember about this is, given this is a second case within a year that we've seen on this issue, clearly the IRS is aware of the issue and they're starting to ask questions. Next up, Private Letter Ruling 2015-38010. This is just a reminder to us of S corporations that lose their status as S due to excess passive income. If your S corporation has accumulated earnings and profits as of the end of a tax year, and it goes three straight years with excess passive income, which is not passive income under the 469 rules, but is basically passive income, more of investment income generally, and the definition actually, which is in our write-up, tells you more about it, simply investment income. If you have that, makes up more than 25% of gross income for three straight years, you cease to be an S corporation as of the beginning of the fourth year. This particular corporation did that. Now, there's also a tax that applies on this particular excess amount, and that particular tax there is automatic relief from the tax. So the entity did not run into trouble there where it would run into the automatic tax under 1375. If they were not aware they had E&P, you can get out of that automatically, but it does not solve the problem of losing your status. So to get your status back, you still must get a private letter ruling to restore S status, meaning paying the user fee for one and paying for the professional advice to get one done. Or if the professional is somehow at fault here for not having raised the issue, then the professional is going to eat a lot of time getting this done. In this particular case, one item of note was that the IRS required a payment to be made by the S corporation. Apparently, we don't know for sure what happened, but it would appear very likely that they had decided that, in fact, they were aware they had E&P, they just weren't aware that it caused them to lose their status. So the IRS was requiring them to make up a payment likely for years beyond the years that were still open in order to not have their S status retroactively revoked. And in order to do that, they required a payment to be made. As always, the IRS can impose conditions upon granting relief in cases like this, and they did here. Next up, a development if you had been following the Morehouse case. IRS Action on Decision 2015-02, the IRS says specifically they disagree with the holding of the Eighth Circuit in the case of Morehouse versus Commissioner, 114 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2014-5340. That was issued just a little less than a year ago. In that particular case, they held that income from the Conservation Reserve Program, CRP program, of the Department of Agriculture was not SE income for this particular farmer who had not been active in the transaction. They're saying he wasn't required to do anything, right? So they went into that particular background. Now, the Eighth Circuit found that these payments amounted to what were rentals of real estate, and being rentals of real estate, rental of real estate's exempt because the government's renting raw land, would be exempt from SE tax. The IRS now has told us they will not accept that ruling. Now, if you have the exact same facts and you're in the Eighth Circuit, the AOD says, yes, we will follow the case there. But in the Eighth Circuit, if your facts aren't exactly like those of Mr. Morehouse, the IRS has been told, the agents are now being told to challenge the position. They're looking to take another case up. And secondly, it's pretty clear that the IRS will not accept the Morehouse position. That's why they issue these non-acquiescence statements in any other circuit. So if you have a taxpayer that's going to try to hide, that's going to try to not so much hide behind, I guess, because it is a valid case, but if they're going to try to use the Morehouse decision to state they don't owe self-employment tax, you need to discuss with them the fact that the IRS doesn't agree with that position, and unless they're in the Eighth Circuit and they have exactly the Morehouse facts, don't be surprised that the service on exam is going to assess tax for self-employment tax in those situations. Another development on an older one we discussed before, the IRS updated some information on the fact they will no longer issue estate tax closing letters for estates for 706s filed from June 1st, 2015 forward. Now, we knew this. This was announced this past summer that that was going to happen. But now, this week, we had some additional information. Catherine Hughes, an IRS estate, basically estate and gift tax attorney, speaking at the ABA section of taxation meetings, announced that the IRS would shortly change the frequency asked questions that we reference here to add instructions on how the executor, the attorney, the CPA will be able to request a transcript from the IRS that will now flag the fact that the estate tax exam is over and completed and the IRS has assessed what they're going to assess. She did not say they're going to offer some way to get a closing letter. They're simply saying that we're going to give you a transcript. Now we're going to have a little more fun here to get to convince those in other areas, such as probate judges, that the closing letter is no longer available and that this transcript may be the best thing we're going to be able to get to allow them to close out an estate. Keep your eyes open. There could be lots of interesting things happening with regard to this. No more regulations issued by the IRS under Treasury Decision 9740. The IRS issued regulations for private foundations that are making contributions to foreign organizations. Generally, remember, private foundations get subject to excise taxes if they have expenditures, if they don't basically spend enough money on an exempt purpose. And one of those things they can do is give money to other charitable organizations that are not themselves private foundations. Well, that's great if it's a U.S. charitable organization. This is easy. We can figure out they qualify. But if you have, let's say, an organization doing charitable work in India, which does not have a U.S. operation, then your problem is you've got to evaluate whether that Indian organization is operating in a function that makes it equivalent to a U.S. tax-exempt organization. If it does, then your expenditure counts. If it doesn't, it may not count as your expenditure, wouldn't count, in which case then you potentially could face these excise taxes. Well, the question becomes, how does a private foundation make this call? What this ruling tells us, the regs say that the foundation can use good faith reliance on the written, it's important, the word written's there, advice of an attorney, a CPA, or an enrolled agent. That is, the traditional Circular 230 practitioners. If one of those gives you in writing, you've been engaged to, and gives you a written advice in writing with regard to the fact that this organization would qualify under U.S. law and it would not be a private foundation, it would be a public charity, then you're allowed to, in good faith, go forward on that. Now, obviously, good faith means you have no reason to believe that the advice you're getting is wrong. You have no reason to believe that this attorney, CPA, or EA doesn't know what they're doing in this area. Otherwise, that would not be good faith reliance. But the regulation specifically rejected a couple of other options. What they rejected us doing was being able to rely upon the advice of foreign counsel, so we could not rely on the advice of counsel in India. If they're not subject to the U.S. rules, you're not going to get automatic protection. Now, the reg says you could rely on that. It could be reasonable good faith reliance. It could qualify as reliance. But you're not going to be protected. You're going to have to show that you studied deep enough to make sure that the Indian Council understood the U.S. law well enough to make this application. The other thing it did say is they discussed about how the fact that, well, you know, we should be able to, you know, do something. We shouldn't have to pay for advice. And the reg says, well, you don't have to, but somebody's got to be competent to make this call. If the foundation managers themselves, you know, have the background, that's fine. Otherwise, let's be honest, what we're really saying is you're going to be paying for advice. The IRS also indicated they are planning to change Revenue Procedure 92-94 to update it for these regulations. That regulation essentially tells us how to make reasonable judgments and good faith determinations of foreign organization status. They expect that to be updated. If you work with private foundations, you should be aware that that revenue procedure should be coming down the line somewhere in the next few months, you'd assume. Next up, interesting little side that we get here, and we talk about all of our little things here. We're going to talk about what happens sometimes. One of the toughest things to explain to clients is how the fact that the IRS may have allowed something or, you know, let something pass in 1 year does not mean the IRS will always let something pass or that they have to. The IRS does not necessarily have to act consistently. This came up this week in the case of Battle Flat LLC versus United States, a case from the United States District Court of South Dakota, docket number 5:13-CV-05070. Citation 2015 Tax Notes Today 184-15. It was issued on September 21st. Now, the problem we've got here is we have a partnership that filed late. It filed its tax returns late. Now, it was a partnership with 10 or fewer partners. All partners were individuals or estates. We don't know for sure the makeup. We do know they qualified there. And I mention that because Revenue Procedure 84-35 says if you have such a partnership, and if you it's a qualifying, all the interests are held by individuals or estates, and you have 10 or fewer, and all of those individuals or the estates properly reported their flow-through amounts on their returns when they filed them, timely, and, you know, basically that's all been done, that the partnership can automatically get out of the failure to file penalty. In this case, the partnership had failed to file 4 straight years on time. Now, okay, 8435 is a small partnership. It would qualify for relief except for one little problem. Not only was the partnership filing returns late, but some of the partners apparently filed their returns late. Now, the IRS granted relief for 2 of the 4 years. Interestingly enough, it appears to be the first and fourth year. But then they issued denials of relief for years 2 and 3. The partnership was, shall we say, somewhat perplexed by this. Obviously, they're not offering back the 2 the IRS waived, but they said, wait, the IRS has to act consistently here. Since the IRS waived the penalty for year 1 and 4, then they have to act consistently. The facts are basically the same for years 2 and 3. The IRS must waive the penalty. The district court held that that is not the case. The IRS does not need to act consistently in that regard. In fact, as the court pointed out, guys, you got lucky. They, per the revenue procedure, they weren't required to waive year 1 or 4, but they did. You should just be happy with what you got is almost the way the judge seems to be writing it. And the IRS is not going to be penalized for being lenient in 2 of the years and being forced to be lenient in all 4. Therefore, the penalties are valid. Well, the partnership went on for one other way of trying to deal with this, and they tried to argue that Revenue Procedure 8435 itself was not a reasonable interpretation of the law. The law in question does say the IRS is to, you know, grant that relief, you know, under regulations issued by the service, relief will be granted for certain partnerships that, you know, are meet these size requirements. However, the partnership said nowhere in there did it say anything about the individual partners having to file the returns timely. However, the district court found that the IRS requiring the partners to file the returns timely was a reasonable imposition, reasonable and in line with what Congress was intending to do. The idea of this rule was to not penalize the partnership if the government's interests were never harmed. If the partners themselves aren't reporting the income, then the government's interests have been harmed. That is, there's a late filing. The IRS was not aware that they should be chasing after these partners for these items for the years in question. Because of that, the court found that it was a reasonable interpretation, and therefore Revenue Procedure 8435 stood. Therefore, the partnership did not get out of the failure to file timely returns penalty for the 2 years where the IRS denied relief. Next up, we have an interesting issue regarding tracking of date of mailing of a return. This is the case of Tilden versus Commissioner. Actually, in this case, it's date of mailing of a tax court petition. Same basic provisions under 7502 will apply to returns. So we'll take a look at this case. This case deals with an attorney who has prepared the petition for the taxpayer, for the Mr. Tilden. And he prepared the petition apparently on the last day for filing the petition. These cases always involve things filed on the last day. It's just the nature of when these things go wrong and when these things happen. He had used stamps.com to print a certified mailing label and the postage. Now, stamps.com, like any other postage meter system, is going to put a date on there. Now, it's important to remember that date was not applied by the U.S. Postal Service. Stamps.com has no way of knowing if you mailed that package or not. The regulations do not basically grant you any protection necessarily for that. The petition actually arrived at the tax court a number of days late. In fact, longer down the line than you would have expected. Under the general regulation, if no postmark is applied by the Postal Service, then the reg says we're going to assume the date it was mailed is how long it should take. If it gets there by the time it should take, had it been mailed timely, given the class of service mailed, the number of days the Postal Service claims letters should take to get there. And first-class letters, generally the presumption for those inside the continental U.S., is that things will get there within 2 days. So if you're more than 2 days after the day of the petition, the assumption is, unless you can prove timely mailing in a way the regulations allow, you're out of luck. If there's no postmark on there, and in this case there was no U.S. United States Postal Service postmark, because that's the number one test, that always qualifies, then your only other option is to show that you did it by registered or certified mail. And to prove that, you have to show a receipt stamped by a U.S. Postal Service employee that documents the date it was received by the Postal Service. The other way you can do it, as we discussed a couple weeks ago, is private delivery services. You could have them pick it up. Obviously, he didn't. Now, the interesting aside was what the tax court did here, though. The IRS said, wait, it was metered. It arrived more than 2 days afterward. That's the end of the discussion. The taxpayer said, wait. I got it from stamps.com. I printed it out that day, and I really put it in the system. The tax court said, well, we're not really going to go with either one of you on this issue. Rather, they looked at the fact, since this was in the system, the United States Postal Service tracking database. Certified letters of this sort are tracked in that database. They went there, got a printout from the Postal Service of the tracking of this letter. And unfortunately for the taxpayer, the first time it showed up in their database was 2 days after the due date, was 2 days after the date, the last day it should have been mailed. The tax court reasoned that the Postal Service had no reason to doctor that information and that it was a neutral party. Neither the IRS nor the taxpayer could make a change to that entry. So because of that, the court said, we're going to accept. And the court cites back to a couple of other cases stating that as far as it's concerned, that information in the tracking system for a letter that is tracked, and not all letters are, but for a letter that is tracked, is tantamount to a postmark if the letter itself does not contain a postal system postmark. The taxpayer argued, which you know, now, of course, they're in trouble because this will not be timely and their petition is going to be thrown out. They argued, well, it's wrong in the system. The tax court pointed out what the regulations say. If you do not get that stamped little white piece of paper or the documentation of the private delivery service, you take the risk that the postmark will not be timely applied. So if you don't go ahead and get that little white slip of paper with the date stamped on it by a Postal Service employee, please remember, by a Postal Service employee. We had the case a couple of years ago where somebody went to a mailing store, like a mailboxes, etc., or a UPS store who will do certified mailing, and that receipt doesn't count either. You need one stamped by the Postal Service employee showing timely mailing. If you don't do that, you take the complete risk that the Postal Service might not postmark it till the next day. In this case, what may have happened, we don't know, but it would be a plausible thing to assume that the taxpayer, you know, basically, it may have simply been dropped in a mailbox. It could have been, as often happens in many offices, handed to the letter carrier who delivered the office's mail, who took it back to the postal office. Of course, if that carrier gets delayed and doesn't get back to the post office before the cutoff for mailing for the day, it's going to end up in the next day's mail, which is going to cause us a problem. So in this case, again, our standard rule, always get the certified mail receipt. But if you have a client who didn't use that but did send it in a way that's in the tracking database, you can use this as authority to argue the IRS down if they're claiming you didn't file something timely, if the tracking database actually shows it got to the Postal Service within the tracking time frame. So it could be a useful case. You don't want to rely on this because it's much better just get that white slip of paper. It solves everything. But if, you know, if the world doesn't come to you that nicely and the client's already done something, this gives us a way to get an out. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September 28, 2015. Be sure to go online and visit our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we have information about all of these cases and links to most of them in full detail, so you can go read the actual document in question and apply it. Also, check there during the week, because we'll do updates in the next week about items that arise in federal taxes. And be sure to join us next week for more information regarding developments in the area of federal taxes.